Hello, and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig Dale, the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. Welcome to 2024 and Season 6 of the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I can't believe I've been doing it for this long, so thank you everyone who listens in every week. To see ourselves as others see us is one of my favourite Burns quotes, and appropriate given the week, though we could reverse the gaze a little more too. To see ourselves in how others see themselves, perhaps. Much of Scotland's measure of success or failure essentially boils down to whether or not we're beating the UK average, or perhaps worse, simply being better than England. We rarely look beyond these islands, and rarer still do we seek to apply the lessons learned elsewhere to ourselves. Scotland's neighbours are all different. They all have their own viewpoints, their histories, and they've all made their way in the world in ways that can offer those lessons, should we seek to learn them. My guest this week, to share some of those lessons, is writer, broadcaster, filmmaker, and fellow podcaster, Leslie Riddick, who's touring with her new film on one of those neighbours, Denmark, The State of Happiness. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Hi, thanks, Craig. Happy New Year, if it's not too late for all that kind of nicety.
And to you yourself, and I should say, given that we've known each other so long, it is appalling that it's taken me so long to get you onto the Policy Podcast. So apologies for that, but I'm really glad you're here.
Grand.
So we'll start off. You've spent many years now looking towards countries in the northwest of Europe, particularly the countries of Scandinavia, as a source of inspiration for Scotland. What first sparked your interest in our Nordic neighbours?
Having a family from Caithness. To be blunt, I mean, we travel, obviously, from my accent, I grew up in Belfast, but we went up every summer on holiday to Caithness, to Wick, where my mother's family came from. And, they were all just, I mean, I had an uncle, cousin and grandfather all called Magnus Moore. I thought everyone had Magnuses in the family, you know, but evidently not. We played in sands at Rees, Keese, the kind of neighbouring areas all had Nordic names. There were gyoes everywhere. And again, I just thought that was pretty normal, really. And of course, the Caithnesians think they're Vikings and get, it's another long story, but tend to get quite antsy when, you know, they have to do Gaelic street signs because they think they're not sort of Scots in that respect. Which is another, as I say, long story. There was Gaelic and Caithness too. But still, the point is that everybody in the family just kind of thought, yep, Norway, we're as Norwegian as we are Scottish. And then finally, I kind of got to the stage of my brother and I took my mum over in search of moors. It's so stupid, actually, in hindsight, in the county called Moore and Romsdal. This is a bit like looking for people called Caithness in Caithness and Sutherland. There just aren't many people called Caithness. So we didn't find any Moors in Moore and Romsdal, but by gum, did we find a society that was kind of like Scotland, but just sort of not like it in the degree of functionality in it and connectivity and tunnels everywhere. I can remember my mum, who was in her 70s at that point, chipping somebody kind of coming off a bus. How do you afford all these tunnels to these wee islands off shore? And I mean, amazingly, people gamely stood and had these funding conversations with mum in the street. And that sort of got me going. But, you know, as I say, the rest is kind of history. I set up Nordic Horizons with another guy, Dan Wynn, who's actually a Labour Party member. So this was to just say, look, these places are same size as us. Yep, they're independent. They're doing a lot better. What can we learn?
My own Viking roots are rather more indirect. The family legend is that the Dale clan was founded by a Norman knight. Norman, of course, meaning Northman.
Yep, yes, indeed. That's descendants of Rollo. If you've been watching your Vikings series, you'll see that all, you know, in stunning technicolor. And I think, you know, the fact that there has been these series, Vikings, and then even The Last Kingdom, who knew that the Danes ran England?
Exactly. You know,
844 till 1000, roughly, Dane law stretched from London to Chester. So, and then, of course, that was before they even had the Norman, which was enough, just as, you know, Rollo and co from either Norway or Denmark, you know, it's arguable. But anyway, I mean, these guys basically laid siege to Paris and were given Normandy. Again, there you are, Norman. So, you know, the idea that these folk were not pretty pivotal in history is kind of just, it's there in the names.
So, what was your objective in producing this new film on Denmark?
I mean, I've been making a, in hindsight, it seems to be a series. It didn't seem like that at the time, of films about the wee Nordic neighbours, because fundamentally people don't really know much about them. And so comparisons in Britain are always drawn with the countries that London sees as being sort of worthy and similar sized. So that's France and Germany, basically. And you know, that's fine. It's often America, because in a sense that's where our bloodlines went. But I mean, a country of what, nearly 300 million people, yeah, you know, how much has that got to say to Scotland, which is 5 million? So here's this little block of countries that are doing tediously well at stuff, is the other point. And when the Scottish Parliament started, it was obvious that people were looking around for sort of templates. We didn't want to just do not London, but actually, you need some inputs. If you've lived in Britain, you know nothing but Britain. And all you're doing is just moving the dial a little bit on what are usually utterly weird ways of running a country. And it's only when you start looking around the place you realize how weird they are. You know, the first time you go somewhere else, you think, by gum, they've got tiny little councils here. That's weird. And then you discover, actually, we're the only people who are sitting with, you know, councils the size of small countries. But anyway, so having done Iceland, Norway, Faroes, Estonia, I mean, Denmark seemed to be the next obvious one because it's the one that draws so many comparisons with Scotland, really. So that was it.
But can you give us an overview of those comparisons? How does Denmark compare to Scotland?
Well, it's got the same population, half the land mass. It sits with some much the same sort of weather conditions. I mean, the Danes keep sort of moaning slightly that they've got a rainy kind of climate, and you think, you just haven't come to Scotland, mate, you know. But there's a lot of differences. It's a low-lying country. The highest part of it, I seem to remember, is 525 feet. So you know, it's really as flat as a pancake, and it's sandy. You know, it's quite fertile. It's a land of farmers, actually. So differences, well, you know, they started pretty early doors. In a way, the Danes and the Scots went in opposite directions. Scotland was its own country, got amalgamated into a larger union. Denmark basically was in charge of practically everything and lost the lot. So it ran it. It actually owned at one point Estonia, but lost that fairly early doors, 1200. Then it lost Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland in 1944, Greenland and the Faroes, highly devolved areas. Obviously, it lost England. But key point, it lost Schleswig-Holstein. Now, I mean, this might be rumbling something in people's memory banks about the Schleswig-Holstein question from school. And then you think, hey, that was the question. What was the answer? What happened was that these two little duchies, Schleswig and Holstein, Schleswig, Danish speaking, Holstein, mostly German speaking, were sitting like wee buffers between Denmark and Germany. And the Danes wanted to formally incorporate them properly into the Danish state, partly because Schleswig spoke Danish. So they've been kind of chewing it around for ages, and the Danes came up with a constitution, modernized their society nearly completely in about 1859, 49, and then thought, look, let's just sort this out. So their way of sorting it out was to basically just annex the two. Now, this was a bad move because the guys on the other side of that were Bismarck. You don't need to remember much of your history to go, Bismarck, Iron Chancellor, you dinny mess. So Bismarck was furious. The Germans pretty much invaded, not and just took back those two wee duchies, but actually pretty much took the whole of Denmark. And in 1864, Denmark nearly ceased to exist. It was that big. And the only reason that Denmark stayed on the map was because the other powers, Russia, Britain, France, didn't want Bismarck getting any more land. So that's how much those guys were cuffed out of the heat. You know, they had the blooming lot and they lost it all. Now, I don't know if you can think of another country kind of nearby, or indeed one that we might be living in, that is kind of coming to terms with and not managing to come to terms with losing an empire, mostly 100 years ago, actually, or let's not exaggerate, the 1960s was a big offloading time, so it's not that long, perhaps 60 years ago. Whereas the Danes seem to just move so quickly from having been in charge of everyone to really a very modest new future as the smallest and almost least effective country in Europe. in the early 1900s. So that is quite fascinating, really. And in fact, all the films uncover a moment in history where you would look at these people and say, do you know, I wouldn't give you tuppence for that. I mean, Estonia in 1991, when they became independent, coldest winter for 30 years, they severed all their links with the Soviet Union, with Russia, and just went cold turkey completely, had to find contracts in the West, had no links, did away with their entire communist workforce, or their politicians from the past, jumped two generations. I mean, you think, geez, no, I mean, these guys have got no chance. And they are the, you know, the digital tiger economy of the EU now. So I think it's always, I'm always fascinated in these moments of history, because there's the parallel for Scotland, with so many people going, oh, well, see, Scotland's different. We're sort of totally screwed because of this, that, and the next thing. You go, aye. Everybody's been totally screwed at some point. You know, it's a question of really what resources you have to reset yourselves. And that's, I think, the lesson. It's the resilience of all these countries. It's not about just taking a template down and going, oh, aye, let's be Denmark. It's saying, you know, we have got a different configuration of possibilities, far more resources and a different history. But what we have to learn to respect and we could well emulate is building resilience and cooperation into a system, which is what the Danes have done par excellence.
Talking about those resources, one of the other parallels Scotland often makes is to Norway, two countries that have vast mineral resources that have used them in different ways. Does Denmark have any of those kind of geographic resources that help bootstrap it up, or has its resources come from other angles?
Well, actually, it is currently the largest oil and gas producer in the EU, which is only really because we left. You know what I mean?
Yeah, true.
Still, it's a big jump down to the Danes, but still, that's not nothing. And yet they've decided that they will issue no new oil and gas licenses, and they will stop producing oil and gas in 2050. Full stop, the end. And the thing that's interesting about them is that because they have a proportional parliament, and every government generally is a coalition, what happens is that people have a buy-in to a policy. Even if the coalition changes, the partners in it abide by what they agreed. So way back in the 70s and the OPEC oil crisis, everybody was stung by the price hikes. And most countries, I can remember anyway, just had heaved a great sigh of relief when it was over and just went back to gas guzzling as normal. Whereas the Danes kind of thought, jinx, we don't want that. You know, we were nearly crushed there. These guys are, I think, are so conscious of their need to maintain independence, from economic independence in particular, after their own experience. So they thought, no, 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 we're not going back to that. We are now going to keep oil and gas prices high. We're going to make the cost of importing cars crippling. We're going to invest hyper big time in public transport. And just by the by, we're going to do wind energy really big time, putting some investment and backing a small company called Vestas, which was a group of three blacksmiths in Denmark. I mean, you know, the rest is history. They now produce a fifth of the world's wind turbines. That should have been us.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's the thing. And they've kept that going, that approach to oil and gas, so that they have a coalition. They have nine parties in their parliament. They currently have a fairly unique left-right sort of government that has problems. I mean, there's a lot of criticisms about them we could come to. But the beauty of it is nobody wants to dismantle the welfare state, and nobody's really arguing about that 2050 completely non-negotiable, we're off deadline.
Now, the film is called The State of Happiness. Is happiness a political goal in Denmark, perhaps similar to the talk here about things like the well-being economy? Or is this an outcome that just grows out of having a state that does aim for more equality and more wealth in the hands of people?
You know, everybody knows that everybody that we interviewed would know that Denmark is either top or second, really, in the UN well-being happiness index. And they are a blooming cheery bunch. I mean, if you look at the, I've seen the film quite a number of times now, and what a bunch of smilers they all are, even the ministers. You know, there's no sort of dourness about people. They look vigorous and smiley, you know, would be the sort of Danish thing. But I don't think that's what the film's not trying to say that's what they're aiming at, or in fact, I don't think that is their direct aim. If they had an aim, I would say now it's cooperation. They build that in so early doors with everything they're doing. And the thing that really gets people and got us when we were doing the film is their education system. It's just mind-blowing. Like everybody else except Britain, it's standard kindergarten from 3 till 6 or 7. And that it's the place we went was outdoors. So that's a lot about negotiation because the kids are having to sort of negotiate their way into little friendship groups and so on. A lot about direct experience, a lot about building confidence and pals and whatever. Off you go to school. Then at the age of 15, you get this utterly unique year where all 15-year-olds are eligible to go to what's called an efterskole. You can use your Scots to guess at that. It's kind of after school. That's because back in the day, and my parents were certainly, this was true, in country areas in Scotland, people left school at 14. Both my parents did. It didn't mean they were dunderheads, just that was it. They were needed, you know, elsewhere. So after school was at 15, same in Denmark. They were all gone off to be farmers. I think, and I mean, I stand to be totally corrected on this, but I can't find anybody who feels the need to try and explain this because, of course, in your own country, things are like that because they were like that. You know, you don't need to scratch too hard. But there was land reform in 1813. All farmers really got security on the land. That meant that Denmark's future was going to be steered much more by the lumpen masses, if you like, than any kind of nobility. And some very influential characters came to bear on that, arguing that the farmers needed to be educated, and they did not mean rote learning. They didn't mean, you know, sort of sitting in serried ranks or whatever. A very influential guy called Niels Grundtvig came to the fore. He was a Lutheran pastor, a bit of a Renaissance guy, actually. But his view was that it was important to be able to vocalize, it was important to be a citizen, to be active, and to have, you know, learning for a purpose. And all of that went into this efterskole, which is a year at 15 where you can go spend the year with other 15-year-olds away from home, learn something you love. The one we went to specialized in diving, and do all the academic stuff on the side. I mean, what's not to like? Half the cost of that is sponsored by the government, and half has to be found by the parents. And that, you know, that's a point because it is expensive. We worked it out. I can't remember. It was about 4 or 5,000 quid you had to find. But you could sort of say 4 and 5,000 quid to cover a 15-year-old's being away for a year. And it's just such an, everybody we interviewed said the efterskole changed that year, changed their lives completely because you learn to cooperate. That was the main thing. You live together, you cook together, you work together, you pick one another up together, you dive together, you just do, you become a society and you learn what it is to be responsible for one another. I mean, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think back to my own time at about that age, and it is. You do get hit by formative events that can completely change the direction of your life. I was 15 when I decided I wanted to become a physicist, for example, and that just set me off on a completely different path of life that ultimately led me here.
Yeah. How did you have what moment created that for you?
Oh, it was actually my physics teacher in science class who was explaining an experiment and said, this is how this works. But if you want to know exactly why it works, you'll need to study physics at university. They'll tell you in your second year. Well,
Okay.
I now need to find out. So
How
that sparked
suggestive
that
are
love.
you, Craig DL? But I suppose the thing that they're all feeling in Denmark is that they need to create, basically, to keep creating the fundaments of a cooperative society. You don't do it by just crossing your fingers, saying sweet things to one another, vote, even voting left and sort of not, you know, think priding yourself on not being a Tory, that's not enough. These guys are baking in cooperation to everything they do. And while we're at it, you know, they have to cooperate. At the moment, the Social Democrats actually, very unusually, could have a government on their own, but they're cooperating in a coalition, because that does bake in all the agreements that are made are then, you know, sealed in. So I think we've a long way to go to realize how very adversarial we still are in Scotland as a product of British thinking that we haven't really dusted down. You know, because we've got a bit of a kind of proportional bit in our parliament, we think, yo, you know, we're the cool cats. No. You know, if STV, and we could have a long argument about this, but you know, if truly proportional voting is okay for councils, why are we not doing it at Holyrood? And why are we not talking about it? You know, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean that could take us down a completely different path on parliamentary reform work I'm actually going to be doing this year, so keep an eye out for that. One of the critiques made towards you, and I saw this play out on the open sewer that is social media, and that you've addressed in one of your recent columns, is that Denmark has its own unique history that Scotland simply can't just replicate. It can't just copy good things that are happening elsewhere. Is that true?
Well, I mean, there's a thing, you know, historians would call path dependency, so that it's very hard to sort of hop right across from one path to another, because all the sort of decisions that tend to be made are very dependent on the path that's already been taken. I mean, I'm trying to remember who said that very recently. I think it was it no, it wasn't Richard Dannett, but it was I may be mixing my big old boys up, but it was a former ambassador who was speaking about the decision to basically bomb Yemen, and of course the British government said they had no choice, and he said, well, they had no choice given their previous choices. You know, they had chosen to be poodles of America, and once America moved, the pattern was that Britain would just follow suit. So given that, they had no choice, which was a beautifully, I thought, barbed kind of response. So the thing is, of course, everyone's free to choose stuff, but you do have these paths that have been taken. So, you know, the Danes, like everybody else, got to the stage of realizing that, you know, land ownership was a pretty major obstacle to be, you know, held in just a tiny number of hands, and got that mostly started in 1813 and completely finished in 1901. Now, there's people might think, yeah, but we don't live on the land really these days, and it doesn't really matter. Yeah, right. So that absolutely transformed Denmark and attitudes within Denmark. And that's one we can't just hop in now, because they've had that 100, 200 years of owning stuff, of being taken seriously as working people and running and owning assets. Only very recently they had an amalgamation of municipalities. So until about 5 years ago, same population as Scotland, they had 290 councils. We have 32. They've now shrunk that down to 98. There's quite a lot of, you know, annoyance about that actually, but you know, it's the smallest of any of the Nordics, but it's still three times as many as us. So another characteristic we can't hop on board with and suddenly have is the experience of actually being very locally run. And of course, if you're going to start trying to do things like district heating networks, it's very difficult to place them on a template where there's nothing. Which is, you know, what Scotland, Britain has, is that there's nothing at the organic size of communities to hold and organise these very, essentially very straightforward ways of sharing energy around a local area. So that one, you can't skip into that either. So there's plenty of stuff you can't skip into. But then having said that, you know, if you look at what happens when countries become independent, let's take Estonia, for example. The Estonians managed almost in about 5 years flat to ditch the education system that had been forced on them by Russia since they'd been part of the Soviet bloc, a very sort of, you know, didactic kind of old-fashioned, if you like, form of education. And they pivoted right round to basically adopt the education system of their cousins in Finland. Now, in that respect, you know, that they speak the same language, the Finns and the Estonians and the Hungarians. I mean, pretty much it's a utterly nothing like the other Scandinavian languages, so they're kind of off on their own with that one. Geographically, the two countries, Finland and Estonia, are totally similar. Lochs, bogs, trees. And so they were able to kind of get shot of the external imperial influence, if you like. They didn't have to have Russian as their either first or second language suddenly for the first time in, almost a century. And so they were able to, they'd made the conscious decision to embrace the Finnish education system, which at that point was topping the PISA charts regularly. Well, it's Estonia that's now doing that. So, of course, everything is particular. But on the other hand, I think there's enough sort of fellow feeling between Scotland and a lot of the Nordic countries that people would just be quite willing, as they have been all the time I've done Nordic Horizons. It's astonished me that the one thing Scots have got that no other country has got is the willingness to turn out in terrible weather to watch films about other countries in the middle of the winter. There's nobody else doing that. We know this isn't a good enough way to organize a society. We're just looking for examples and for knowledge, really, about how the other more than half lives.
On the other side of that, is there a danger that those who oppose efforts to improve Scotland or to learn lessons from elsewhere, that they just develop a sense of a resigned, ach, it's aye been, that could threaten to hold us all back?
Well, I think those folk have got that one, whether you're, I mean, I've, some of the comments on social media are just truly gobsmacking. I mean, I would be kind of ashamed to be saying some of the stuff people are, and it's not just because it's nippy, it's just utterly nihilistic. It's kind of, we are crap, get with it. That's what it's essentially saying. The Danes are not crap, we are crap. So if that's as good as it gets, your argument, I don't think. Comparators only seem to annoy because it sort of suggests you have the conceit to think that actually your future might be in your own hands.
Another critique that kind of was going around at the same time was, well, you have to take the good with the bad, don't you? And people can point at something in Denmark that they don't like, whether it's high taxes or maybe conservative politics that they object to, and say, well, if you want all the good bits, you have to take that as well. Is that an attitude you agree with?
Well, people are people and they're entitled to approach this any way they want. And I mean, that's natural. But I mean, what I'm trying to do is say, yeah, absolutely, let's just take the entire shooting match. I mean, the Nordics generally are, well, this is a generalization because this is not so true of some of them, but are very white. I mean, Sweden has changed that because it took more refugees per head of the population than any country in Europe and has had a lot of problems integrating them. I mean, Scotland is actually doing much better than almost any country in our integration of asylum seekers and refugees. So some people would say, there's an innate racism in a lot of these countries. Other people would say they, mostly speaking, didn't have colonies and didn't have the experience that Britain had of bringing in lots of people during the whole of the last century, to sort of, in a sense, have more of a kind of mixed kind of society. So they are kind of stuck in a bit of a groove. But I mean, so all those things are true. And I'm not saying, I've never been saying we just lift a template and we be Sweden or we be Norway. But I'm trying to say, instead of having these abstract arguments about if we're in charge of Scotland, we can run it ourselves, or, we tend to vote in a communitarian, social democratic way. Yep, we do, sort of thing. But what does that mean? It means that if you have higher levels of trust and people are willing to pay higher levels of tax, you will get, the excellent elderly care that the Swedes have, which is instituted not just to, take care of older people, but actually to re release 50-year-old women it back into the workplace, because it's women my age and younger who usually end up taking care of their mothers in other societies where elderly care is rubbish. So if you want, even from the point of view of keeping your economy going, and that was the Swedes' kind of interest, you need to make sure that your elderly care is shit hot. Now, that might be of no interest to somebody in Scotland, but I find that pretty interesting. There are aspects of stuff in Sweden I wouldn't agree with. But I mean, generally, if we've been voting in a certain way and we have for 100 years, They've been voting in the same way for more than 100 years, and look kind of what they've got, because they're a country that could manifest governance structures that reflect their thinking instead of just thinking it. And so, if we're going to go to the next stage, which is to have our hands on the tillers in all sorts of ways, there's some real wake-up calls we need about the centralization of Scotland. It's shocking, and it's holding us all back, and it's undermining the confidence of everyone that's listening to this podcast, whether they realize it or not. So you see that very quickly when you take a rain check, but you also see what very good standards of public service can do for basically nation building. So all of that to me is very apparent now after 13 or 14 years of looking at this closely. And because nobody can spend 13 or 14 years trotting around these countries, the films are just a chance to say, this is how other countries with less resources, mostly than us, have managed to produce what we just can think about.
And how far down the path could Scotland go towards these Nordic horizons while we're still within the Union, with the UK? Or to put it another way, would Denmark be the state of happiness if it was a devolved region of the United Kingdom?
Well, no, it absolutely wouldn't be, but because of many of the presumptions, the kind of the presumption of competition, and an adversarial politics and legal systems that sits at the centre of Britain, plus the acceptance of vast wealth inequality, those two wouldn't wash with any of the Nordic countries. So you just wouldn't have basically had your starter for 10 at all there. It's an interesting one to think for Scotland, because Scotland geologically was separate to England for much of our geological life. And we were, I think, somewhat bunched on to the end of Denmark at one point. You know, actually, if we had been a part of Denmark, I wonder if we would be having conversations about independence. I guess we would, because Iceland became independent in 1944. The Faroes voted for independence in 1946, a slender margin, and prompted the Danish government to give them truly the world's most devolved parliament. As a result, there's 55,000 people on the Faroes. So, you know, people have been trying to get away from Denmark, even as we're looking at it and purring slightly, because it looks like, you know, what in many respects, what's not to like. But people want to be in charge of their own physical localities, and a lot of that is as cultural as it is political.
Now, we've had all that discussion about the history and path dependency and the interlocking nature of a lot of this. But Leslie, if you could take just one policy from Denmark right now and apply it to Scotland, what would you like to see?
Well, I'm very tempted to say the efterskole, actually, because I think what we're not, I think, aware of is how much Britain is very different in its kind of competitive race to the bottom, judgmental kind of outlook. And we think we're doing all right because, you know, it's tangible here that that is not quite the same. But really, there's a whole step change you can take where you start to build consensus and stuff into society and take the pressure off kids. I mean, we're sitting here talking and hearing regularly about a mental health crisis amongst teenagers. Well, why then are we at a stage where we keep piling the pressure on at about that age, suggesting to kids that, you know, they're going to basically screw up their entire lives if they don't make decisions then? I mean, they're already making them at 11, 9, 8, you know, that will shape their entire lives. Whereas the opposite is happening with the Danes, where they're going, we know the pressure is building up. We believe that you're capable, and that means you're worth spending a year trying to discover who you are. And I mean, it's astonishing to hear really high up officials talking about that finding yourself year. I'm, you know, here that just sounds hopelessly happy clappy, and it just is a kind of demonstration of the Calvinism that sits within us all. You know, that we can think about that and think that would be nice, but no. However, that's the one change I would make, because I think that change would begin to trigger an awful lot of different thinking about the this sort of intensity of pressure that we're putting on teenagers. Just because we went through it doesn't mean to say it's okay.
Oh, it definitely wasn't okay for me, but that's a story for another time. I had my own brushes with mental health in my late teens, early 20s, but that's a topic for another podcast. So the theme of this, the podcast for this year, is Activate. I want to find out from people around Scotland, what are you doing to change that attitude of it's I been? What is actually happening in your area that's going against the grain and pushing up against these barriers that are holding us back? So with that in mind, what can our listeners do if they want to start making all of these things that we've been talking about today happen?
Yeah, that is a really difficult one because, I mean, although I've been very involved with things like community buyouts for most of my life and was a trustee of the Isle of Egg Trust that led up to the buyout, and have watched them actually take their own island and their lives by the scruff of the neck and transform that island, it's really, I'm beginning to sort of feel that there's an awful lot of pressure on people to make the individual changes. So that, for example, and I mean, I know you guys do so much on this work, but I mean, things, for example, at the moment, people are rushing to think about heat pumps because they want to go green. This is crazy. Why are people in cities and flats putting in heat pumps? We should have district heating there. And then, okay, that's hard because at the moment, the price of electricity is so high that it's not washing its face as a proposition. Because I've got to say, because I don't hear Patrick Harvey speak about very much except heat pumps. Everybody's got the feeling that this is their individual, that they have to get on with this and make that change, sinking 20,000 quid into something that will have to get changed in 25 years. So I'm a wee bit wary now about the sort of you can all do something yourself mode. Because the other thing is, yeah, you could all do something. You could do, I mean, the village I live in is practically a DIY village. We've got no bus service. No recycling collection, quite a number of things that just don't, no gritting. So yeah, we definitely do stuff ourselves in as far as we can, but this is crazy. I mean, what are we paying council tax for in the end to just not have any services somewhere and to just become more, kind of great-hearted little people who organize themselves because the structures we have are totally inadequate. So I don't know. I almost feel now that since the SNP clearly aren't interested in any of this, and indeed no party is, there almost has to be something politically that comes out the other end now, because people just trying to shift the dial by making personal changes themselves is kind of it gets you closer to realizing that there has to be political change because you end up banging your head off the wall so much. I just don't want people to spend another 10 or 20 years making small incremental changes that can be swept away so easily by just another tier of government or something. And yeah, I quite take your point. You don't want to sort of descend down into a kind of we can't do anything kind of hopelessness either. And I think that's where the independence campaign is also stuck, because people have tried to do independence, trying to keep campaigning on their own. But unless the kind of the forefront of that campaign, the political campaign, is moving, it just feels like you're just tramping into the guys standing in front of you marching time. So yeah.
Yeah, I do often contrast the very intense local democracy of my friends and family in Europe versus the almost complete lack of it in my own life, in my own village, and the community engagement that goes on or doesn't go on here. So I do wonder if we did have that, if we just build it and let them come, if we start to see that democratic reform, we start to see the benefits of it very, very quickly.
I'm convinced of it now. And actually, I do think it's these things that people, I'm old enough to be a sort of bit of a Monty Python fan. And of course, their sketches, spring to mind unbidden. But the argument sketch is always a good one, where the guy's basically annoyed because he's paid for an argument and just ends up with the other guy saying, "You haven't paid," which is not his idea of the argument he paid for. It's just automatically gainsaying the other guy. So this may seem a bit sort of specious, but people don't want the solution to Scotland's democratic problems to be local democracy because it's boring. They want it to be exciting. They don't want that to be the argument. That's the argument. If you don't believe in yourself, and dear knows how many events I'll do and I'll say to people, what's the biggest asset in Scotland? And people will go through the usual. And I'll say, no, it's you. And if you don't think it's you, we're stuck here forever. And so then people take that as being told off, which they can actually do pretty well being told off. And I'm saying, listen, I'm not wanting you to kind of just look like I've skelped you out of the lug either. I mean, this is really, think about this. Why did nobody in the room think that the people of Scotland are its greatest asset? And then you've got quite a lot of work to do on yourself before you start, taking lumps out of anybody else. And, it doesn't almost matter too much now whose fault this was. This is a major problem for us that we kind of think we need to have inward investment from other places, tax coming in from somewhere else. It's our money. We just sent it to them in the first place. If you really doubt that we have inherently the skills to go forward, and then look at our glorious past of creativity and engineering and much else besides, and somehow feel almost cowed and embarrassed that we are hardly the people our great great grandmothers and fathers were, you're not going to vote for independence, And the other, countries like Norway believed that they were independent when they were still part of Sweden, because they'd passed a law in their own devolved parliament, which basically forbade Oslo from running their municipalities ever. So their idea of independence was, we didn't have those smart arses from Oslo coming and telling us what to do where we live. Where we live, we are kings and queens, and they have not let go of that. So unfortunately, we have, and therefore we don't rate it. But to me, that's the big one that we need to sort.
Well, that's certainly something I'm going to be working on this year as well. So hopefully we'll cross paths doing that. But finally, before I let you go, where can folks see the film?
Yes, well, I'm so almost sorry that it's not online immediately, because I'm sure people just think, right, okay, fine, I just want to see it. And indeed, all the other films are online now. But I spent quite a while, and it was a bit of an effort because it's only me doing it, getting it into 18 or 20 different, cinemas and community venues. And the cinemas in particular are not keen on having stuff online before their screening, because they tend to think, folk won't come if they can just watch it free online. Actually, I don't know that that's true. The first couple of screenings have been astonishing. The turnout's been amazing. They're all almost at the stage now where they're all sold out. Because I think people like the coming together. They like the business of trying to visualize something in a very intense way together, But anyway, so the links for all the bookings of the other 17 or 18 screenings that are ahead are at leslieriddick.com/events. And once the final screening is over, which will be the Cameo in Edinburgh on March the 28th, after that the film will be online at the same, on YouTube, basically. You'll find it there.
And I'll stick a link to the events page in the description of the show.
Grand. Well, thank you.
Yeah. So thank you, Leslie. That's been a great chat. And as I say, long overdue to have you onto the show. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thanks very much. Actually, it's good to have somebody give me a bit of a bit of more of a hard time about Denmark, because that's the trouble. So few people know very much about Denmark that I'm always terrified that there's going to be Danes in the audience who'll say, that's just total bullshit, But yeah, but I'm waiting for that with bated breath.
I'm almost certain that my Danish friends will be phoning me the moment this goes live to tell me all the things I should have asked you.
Yes, yeah.
So thank you. And I'd just like to end the show, as I always do, by reminding folk that Commonweal as an organisation is entirely funded by our donors and supporters, who give us an average of about £10 a month. So if you'd like to support our policy work, our campaigns, and this podcast, please click the donate link in the description of the show. Thank you once again to Leslie, my guest. Thank you to all of my listeners. And I'll speak to you again next week.